trailer, movie, whatever, has the bad guys nearly winning, then the good guys nearly winning, then the bad guys nearly winning again, then the good guys nearly winning again. So the what's going to happen next is more or less that. Okay, except the jury, except the movie hasn't ended yet, so it's not clear who is winning at the end, at the very end, okay? So basically I'm going to tell you that, well, you know, this, we have the Concievich integral, it's an invariant, let's try to compute it for the trefoil. Okay, for any knot. For the a knot, it's been done with a huge amount of effort. Not huge, but I mean big amount of effort, okay? But for, let's compute it for the trefoil, okay, or can we find an algorithm to compute it for an arbitrary knot? So the good news is that we can rather quickly reduce it to the computation of four things, three of which are trivial, and this one. The bad news is that it's completely hopeless to compute this one. The good news is that we don't need to compute this one. We can actually replace it by anything else that satisfies the same equations. Okay? The bad news is that we cannot find solutions to these equations even if we replace them, even if we allow ourselves other solutions of these equations. But then the good news is that, you know, if we mod out by some further relations, we can sometimes simplify a little more. And so, I mean, but anyway, let's start. So the first point is that we can reduce everything to the computations of these things, and let me show you how. So the idea is, you want to compute the invariant of the trefoil. You know that it's an invariant, so why don't you bring it to a favorable position? Why don't you move it around to a position where the computation will appear easy? So here is a favorable placement of the trefoil. You know, it's so much annotated that it's a bit hard to see that it's the trefoil, but like if you look at it very, very carefully, if you trace around, it's the trefoil. Okay? Now, what's good about this position? So at any lowercase t, so lowercase t denotes time slices. So at any lowercase t, if you cut the knot along that lowercase t, what you see, all the points of intersections that you see are along a single line in the complex plane. So they're all along the line, the real line in the complex plane. So everything is just along, well, planar, okay, or, well, okay? And all distances, if you pick any two points, the distance between them will be a power of epsilon, where epsilon is some small number. So, and of course, you should think that it's very, very, very small, but for the purpose of the picture, I made epsilon roughly be a third, so you could actually see something, okay? But basically, the overall width is one. So the distance between any one of these two points to in fact any one of these three points is approximately one. So I mean, from here to here is one, so from here to here is one minus epsilon, and one minus epsilon is roughly one, okay? The distance from this point to that point, to this pair, is about epsilon. And it doesn't matter if you go to the left one or the right one, because the difference between the left one and the right one, the distance between the left one and the right one, is epsilon squared, which is very small relative to epsilon. Okay? And the same goes on everywhere else. At all the time slices, the lowercase t's. Okay? A different way of saying it is that you can read off a parenthetization at any discrete time. So, you know, a parenthetization is Well, you think that you have a bunch of elements in a non-associative algebra, and you dictate in which order to multiply them. So you multiply them, say, in this order. Choosing this parenthetization sort of means that you have two clusters, the first cluster and the second cluster, and the distance between the clusters is one. The left cluster in itself is made of two clusters, and the distance between these two clusters is epsilon. Okay? Of these two clusters, the right one is in itself made of two clusters, each one has a single point, and the distance between these two clusters is squared. Okay? So basically saying that all distances are powers of epsilon is the same as saying that you can read a parenthetization off at every discrete time interval. So here the parenthetization is the empty parenthetization. Here the parenthetization is, well, there are only two strands. I think for some reason I call them A and D. So they're just parenthesis. It's not interesting. But here it begins to be interesting. The parenthetization here is, well, D is multiplied by all of those, so D gets multiplied by all of those, and those appear in the order A times BC, okay, and so on. So I explained the lowercase t's. Now, in between any two lowercase t's, there is an uppercase t, and the uppercase t's correspond to time interval. In each time interval, either one of three basic things happen. And the three basic things are I need a chalk and an empty blackboard. So the three basic things are either you have a creation, a pair creation, annihilation because I'm going from the bottom to the top, or a creation. And what I mean by that is that the pair of things being created are in innermost parenthetization. So there may be more stuff. Okay, there may be more stuff in this little time slice, but the rest is far away, relatively speaking. Okay? Likewise for annihilation, for creation, again, there might be more stuff in the left or on the right or both, but far away. Okay? Second possibility, there might be a crossing in a slice. So, I mean, here is a creation, here is a creation, there are two annihilations at the top, here is a crossing. Now, the crossings have the property, again, the same thing. You might have a crossing, but there may be more stuff at the same level, but it's going to be far, far away. And in fact, allow me to, even though it's not strictly necessary, allow me to allow a little bit more. The things that cross, instead of being single strand, could be in themselves bundles of strands. So this could be a double, or in fact, you know, it could even be a triple. Notice that even within the triple, it has to be with this sort of scaling, okay? But the point is that if this is the case, then the distance scales, the distances between the within each bundle must be tiny relative to the scale of the crossing itself, okay? And the third, and sorry, in fact, this also comes in two variants. There is the upper and the lower. just like here's resources over and under. And finally, there are those associations where a parenthetization changes from A times B to times C to A times BC. And again, well, again, there is also the reverse change. But again, there could be more strands far, far, far away. And each of these strands could be, in fact, a multiple. So, example, here is an association, a reassociation with a faraway strand, and here is a reassociation with one of the strands doubled. Okay? But again, it's doubled in a scale which is smaller. Okay? Let me remove this and, let me put it closer. So, it's clear that every knot can be brought to this position. Is it clear? To such a state? Basically, you take your knot and you, well, you know what? Is it okay if I skip this? And basically, you force the scales to be right in between the interesting parts. The interesting part being the crossings. And then, wherever you see a crossing, you reassociate using the associative law so that the crossing is innermost, is between two strands that are very, very close to each other. Then you cross, and then you reassociate until you're ready for the next crossing. Okay? And so the thing that's hidden behind the hard theorem that's being used here is the theorem that that the associative law is enough to describe associative algebras. So modulo the associative law, you can replace any associativity to any other one, basically. Okay. Anyway, modulo the associative law, you can get from any product to any other product. Sorry, that's what I wanted to say. Anyway, the next claim is that it is enough to compute, therefore, it is enough to compute the Kontsievich integral of a cup, a crossing, and an associativity. Why? Basically, faraway things don't matter. Right? Suppose I already computed this. How do I figure out the invariant of that? Well, there might be contribution from faraway things, but they don't. But since there are, you know, in the denominator there is zi minus zj, and the distance between. The distance from here to here is a lot, so I have a big denominator, and in the denominator I only have a dz, so the dz measures the amount of motion, but the amount of motion is small, so I can ignore chords that go far away. Okay? By the way, in between, okay, I can also ignore chords that are not interacting with my picture at all, because these two strands are parallel. And I have, again, dzi minus dzj is equal to zero if the two strands are parallel. Okay? Likewise, courts that go from here to here don't matter, because these things are parallel. So I only have to worry about cords that go from one side to the other. Okay, from one bundle to the other. Now, these cords, or for these cords, the ones that, okay, the contribution coming from this cord is the same as the contribution coming from a single crossing. Did I do the orientation the same? Yeah. So it's the same as the contribution coming from a cord that appears in a single crossing, except that you get this one with multiplicity. You will get it either ending here or ending here, or you will get all possible ways of ending it within the bundle. You'll get a sum over all possible ways of ending it within the bundle. Okay? And within each bundle, so if it ends here or if it ends here, it makes no difference because these are very close to each other. Okay? So basically, suppose I've computed the invariant of a single crossing, and it came out, so suppose I've computed Z of a single crossing, and it came out to be e to the 1/2 of a chord. In other words, it came out to be, it should be a chord diagram on two strands. So suppose it comes out to be the empty chord diagram on two strands plus the chord diagram with one chord and a factor 1/2 plus the chord diagram with two chords and a factor, what is it? 1/8? I'm just reading the coefficients of e to the 1/2 something. Plus, the next one is 6 times 2 to the 3, that's 48. So 1/48 times, suppose I computed it and this is what came out, and then more. Okay? I'll call this quantity R once and for all, and then Z of Z of this, say, will be the quantity that I will call R put on 1, 2, and 3, 4, R placed on 1, 2, 3, 4, and what it is you take the original R, okay, and you basically every chord gets replaced by the sum of all ways of placing it on, the 1, 2 end on 1 or 2, and the 3, 4 end on 3 or 4. So these boxes indicate sums. Okay? I guess this is, it might be messy, but it's an algebraic operation. There is no further analysis. If I've done hard analysis to compute this, to get from here to here, all I need is algebra. Is it clear? By the way, is it?
Can you say a little bit more about the little boxes coming out of R?
So the little boxes come. So basically, the little boxes coming out of R are the chords ends. The chord ends. So I'm calling this thing R, and I'm thinking of R as having chords going to the left and to the right, or chord ends going to the left and to the right. And basically, any chord end that goes to the left, you sum over the two possibilities of either ending it on 1 or ending it on 2. And any chord end that goes to the right, you sum over the two possibilities of... I mean, in fact, given that R is so simple, so in fact I just told you that R is probably e to the 1/2 t 1/2 using the TIJ notation of braids, okay? And then the conclusion will be that Z of this, can you see this? Well, okay, let me lift it a bit. But the conclusion is that Z of this will be E of 1/2 times T1/3 plus T2/3 plus T1/4 plus T2/4. Okay? I basically converted each T1/2 to the sum of the two. Of the, well, two ways of lifting its left end and the two ways of lifting its right end. Okay? So all of this is supposing I've computed the invariant of this. So go back home and compute the invariant of this. It comes out what I wrote. And there is the computation is completely trivial because when you do the Concievich integral here, all chords commute with each other. So, right, because they are just, because all chords are the same, anything commutes with itself. So it's just an iterated integral over the simple, well, you compute it and that's what comes out.
Commutativity is important, that's why you get such a nice formula.
Yeah, commutativity, yes. And also the fact that the volume of the simplex is 1 over n factorial. That's why you get an exponential. Okay? And I don't know where the half comes from. It just comes from somewhere. Oh, because it's half of a full, the two points are not making a full rotation. One point is not making a full rotation about the other, but just half a rotation. So that's the half. Okay? Anyway, likewise for this. Suppose I was able to compute the invariant of a single associativity, and suppose I called it capital Phi. Okay? If I know capital Phi, I know this invariant. All I have to do is I have to install phi on these three bundles of strands, and what it would mean is that every chord that ends on the leftmost will have to be doubled. You'll have to sum over the two ways of ending it here. Okay?
So, but can't you have a double thing in the middle? The squiggly thing, can there be two parallel things?
Yeah, it could be. This could be a pair. And then, so phi is a chord diagram living on three strands, and now if you want to compute a thing where the squiggly thing is doubled or tripled, you'll have to take every chord end that ends on the middle strand and triple it. Okay? So the point is that once you know this, and these two, you're done. Again, this one I told you what it is, and I more or less told you how to compute. These are a priori hard, but have been done. And this one remains an impossibility. Okay? So before showing you why it's an impossibility, or before continuing, okay, let me start computing phi. Okay? Let me start computing this phi, which, by the way, is called an associator. Because it, well, reassociates. Okay? It goes from one, well, it applies the associative law. So it's called an associator. So let me try to compute it. So I don't think I want to do it in great detail, but I just want I just want to show you a bit of the computation. So within an associator, let me try to compute the contribution coming from this ordering of chords, this sequence of chords. Okay? So you just right, so the associator will not just include this, it will include all possible placements of chords where you have one chord going to the left from the middle and one going from to the right. You don't have to worry about chords going from the left to the right because the two sides are parallel. Okay? So this is one of 2 to the n terms, where n here is 6. Anyway, the contribution coming from corresponding to this is an integral. Well, okay, again, I'll assume that this is the point 0, 0, this is the point 1, 1. I'll just rescale everything to be right. And then it's an integral over t1 up to t6, which are ordered, of, now you look at the Concievich integral, and it's, let's see, so t6 goes from here, sorry, the chord number 6 goes from here to here. So if this is the line t, okay, z is equal to t, then the factor coming from here is just dt over t, which I believe is what is written here. This is the constant line 1, so this is 1 minus t5, so you get d of 1 minus t5 divided by 1 minus t5, and so on. I hope I didn't make mistakes. Now, so I need to compute this integral. Let's start. Okay? So, first of all, let's compute the integral, what did I do here? I think I just rewrote it. Yeah, sorry, I just rearranged, so the next line, I just rearranged the terms. I don't know where the minus came from. Oh, it's because there are 3 minus signs on top. So, okay, I killed all the d of 1s. They're not too interesting. And I pulled out a minus sign, and then I have this thing. And I wrote it as an iterated integral. So you first integrate for t6 going from 0 to 1. Then t5 has to be smaller, so you integrate dt5 going from 0 to t6, and so on. And also, you know, since I did the T6 integral first, I could pull out the T6 denominator from all the other integrals. Okay? So this integral becomes this. And then let me just evaluate it kind of from the right to the left. So how do I do the integral from 0 to t2 of 1 minus this? Well, I take this thing and expand it as a power series, and it becomes the power series sum of k1 greater than 0 of t1 to the k1 minus 1. I don't know why minus 1, but yeah, okay, whatever. Okay? This is just the power series for 1 over 1 minus t1. Now integrate it, so again I'm evaluating from right to left. So now when I evaluate the integral, well, integrating just divides by k1, divides by the power. Oh yeah, that's why I wrote it in this way, okay? Because I wanted a k1 in the denominator, not a k1 plus 1. Okay, now I need to integrate. Sorry, now I take the thing written here, and what do I do with it? Oh, divide by T2. Divide by T2 just lowers the K1 to K1 minus 1, and I integrate again, so I get K1 squared in the denominator. And basically you keep going through this and evaluate the whole thing, and you'll have to believe me that at the end you get a sum over k1 up to k3 of, 1 over some power of the first k, some power of the sum of all three, and then you can change variables, and call K1 N1, call K1 plus K2 N2, and call the whole sum N3. Sorry, it's barely visible, I know. Is it visible? And now you have a sum over an ordered three tuple of numbers of a thing like this. Okay? This is the so-called, okay, this is the definition of the multiple zeta values. So if you had a single variable here, you'll have a sum over one over n to some power, and that's an evaluation of the Riemann zeta function. This is sort of the many variable generalization of the Riemann zeta function. And so the conclusion is,
so the number of variables that you get is equal to the terms where the 1 minus something in the denominator.
Sorry?
So the number of variables that you get, these N1, N2, N3, are in general equal to the number of terms in your iterated integral such that the denominator is 1 minus something instead of just a variable.
Yes. So, I mean, the sort of the example is sufficient to figure out what is the bijection between like pictures like this and multiple zeta values. But there is a bijection. So any multiple zeta value comes from a picture like this and vice versa. The exam, if you stare at the example sufficiently long, you'll figure out the bijection. So anyway, understanding the Knisnik, or writing the, so the good news, there is a formula for the Knisnik-Zhemolodchikov, for the KZ associator, for the Koncievich integral of an associativity, which involves only multiple zeta values. And the bad news is that nobody knows anything about multiple zeta values. So I'm lying. People know a great deal about multiple zeta values, but everything that they know is in the language of conjectures. So if all of these numbers were rationals, we would be delighted. Okay? If all of these numbers were transcendental, we would also be delighted, because within an algebraic context, so the computation, once you've computed the value of an associator, the remainder of the computation of the value of the trefoil is a completely algebraic process. So if all of these were transcendental, and all you do to them is algebraic things, you have put them together as algebraic things, then that's the same as saying that they're all just completely independent variables. You could, substitute into zeta 312 pi, and into zeta 378 e, or you could just replace each one of them by a variable, because you do algebraic things to them and they satisfy no relations. Unfortunately, they are neither. So there is a conjectured structure of multiple it's conjecturally known or suspected what are all the algebraic relations between the multiple zeta values, but A, it's complicated, and B, it's not proven. So in some sense, it's a useless answer. Okay? And in another sense, it's useless for me as a knot theorist. It's actually useful for number theorists. So number theorists care about multiple zeta numbers for their own reasons, Let me tell you, I think the reasons are mostly beauty. So if I don't think there is anything really important that depends on multiple zeta numbers, but sort of they, you know, since they spend so much time studying the Riemann zeta function, they also want to study, or it's, I'm not sure that there is any deeper reason, but still, number theorists care about multiple zeta values, and since in some sense an associator is the generating function of all multiple zeta values, anything you prove about associators is a theorem about multiple zeta values. And in fact, there is an industry of such theorems. So people work on it. What?
Don Zagier,
Ferruccio,
Goncharov,
right. Francis Brown. That was the name that was escaping my mind. Anyway, there is a whole industry. But from my perspective, nothing good will ever come out of it. Okay, from not theoretic perspective, limited.
What theory will add something to number theory?
What?
As you said, if you can prove something really nice about associators.
Yeah. Anyway, at least you know what. At least for now, it's a dead end. Maybe someday somebody will do something, but at the moment it's a dead end. Okay? So here's the next thing. So I now know, how much time do I have?
About 10 minutes.
So maybe, okay, I'll sketch what I will do next and then I'll decide whether to actually do it or do it next time. Okay? So, and I've definitely fallen behind. But anyway, so I now know that in order to compute anything I want, the invariant of any knot you want, all I need is to know, I need to know those four quantities. And as I mentioned, only one of them is hard. But it's very hard. Okay, so now the idea is, why do I care if the value of this quantity comes from the Messi-Kontsievich integral? Why don't I make up a value for this quantity? So I'll make up a value for this quantity, but I have to make it up in such a way that the computation I will get will be consistent. Okay, I have to make it up in such a way that that all the relations are satisfied. So basically, I'm basically saying that in some algebraic context, these are generators. If I find the set of relations between them, then all I need is to find values for these generators that satisfy the relations, and I don't care if they come from the Kontsievich integral or from some completely different place. So I'll skip straight to the interesting relations. So there are many relations to check. All of them are trivial, except these. Okay? So what do these relations say? So the first one is the pentagon, and let me write it in a way, I didn't take a picture of this, right? So let me write the pentagon the way it was born. And it was born in category theory. And maybe also in homotopy theory, and sort of the way it was born over in category theory is in the following picture. So if you have four things and they are associated this way, you can apply associativity on the inner two, and you will go to A times BC times D. Now you can say Well, consider these two as computed products, or really it's still a product of three things. And let's reassociate it, and it will become A times B D times D. So, BC times D. Then in here I can apply associativity, so I'll get A times B times CD, and I've kind of gone from the original associativity to its reverse. But I could have done the same thing by applying associativities in a different order. So I could have taken this as a done product and multiplied this, and then I have, well, you know, if you think of this as a single X, then I have X times C times D, and I can reassociate it to be A times, sorry, X, so AB times CD. And then this can be reassociated to be that by thinking of C and D as a single term. So if the associative law doesn't hold, but instead it fails and there is some price to pay, then the price here plus the price here plus the price here should be equal to the price here plus the price here. Because at the end they get to the same thing. So that's where it came, that's how it came in homotopy theory, and for obvious reasons it's called the pentagon. Okay? So in our world, that's the pentagon. So if you take an associator, you add a strand far away, meaning you do nothing. You just add a strand with no links between it and here. And then you multiply it by another associator in which the middle strand is doubled, which again means that any chord that ended on the middle strand becomes a pair of chords. And then you multiply it by another associator that is, in which you added the strand at the far left, then that's the same as doubling this first strand times doubling the last strand. And these two things should be the same, because you could get from this one to that one, because they have the same endpoints, and you can get from one to the other by horizontal deformations. Okay? So any value that you will want to put for the associators will have to satisfy this relation, which is called the pentagon. And likewise, there are two hexagons, and they are written here, and I think I will have to go back to this tomorrow and explain it with more care. Okay? So how much time do I have? I hope I have zero, because...
Zero.
Okay, good. Because it's not a good time to start a real discussion. So, but the preview is, so we failed to compute the KZ associator. Let's just replace it by an arbitrary one. Okay.